weddings have been a regular part of my life. There was our wedding, a promised day in local memory for the month of April 1980. We had planned it in April because we had done all these family weddings the year before. There are the people who RSVP that mom was counting on not coming to the wedding because there weren't enough seats. They were the first ones to reply. I laughed, I thought it was going to be a lot better than that. There was the oversight that left Carol and me stranded on the front steps of the church after the wedding. And then a very nice guy took his car keys and threw them to my just this side of Katie. That's it. And then there are the officiating others' weddings and memories. Some of them are downright funny, and some of them are just, I can't believe that actually happened. There was a wedding where the groomsmen painted twice. He came back after the first one, he never came back after the second one. There were the bridesmaids who met me in the parking lot and told me they were all leaving, they had their baggage with them, unless I fixed the he's gone next bride. The bridesmaid who almost made it to the pew before she fainted, but what was even funnier was the nurse who leaked two pews to catch her before she had to walk. Didn't know she had it in it. There was the on the point at the lake wedding that ended with pouring rain that chased everybody to their cars and everybody carried something that was part of the wedding. Down the path through the woods, that's great. And then there are some awkward, weird, totally inappropriate to tell you in a sermon from a platform that feel like things. But when I remember them, they make me laugh out loud. And I'm sure some of you have wedding stories that would fit nicely into my collection of wedding stories. Maybe we can share hot stories and talk about it. Today's journey with Jesus takes place of the wedding. The wedding for that boy and girl next door in the town of Cana in Galilee. It's about the boy and girl who we know nothing about except their banquet master ran out of wine. That's what we know about them. This is the account. It's in John chapter 2 of the Bible. You might want to turn there. Sometimes I like to mark things that I don't want to see. Beginning verse 1, John chapter 2. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee, and Jesus' mother was there. And Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. And when the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to them, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour is not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." And nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. And Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And so they filled them to the brim. And then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." And he did so. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. And then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best until now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs, to put that in context, the first of the seven signs that the Apostle John used in his gospel, through which he revealed his glory to his disciples. Now, if Jesus' encounter with Satan in the wilderness was a private matter, the two of them, that we know about because it was recorded in the gospel, this scene is the total opposite. It is a miracle in broad daylight. And yet, very, very few people knew that it was a miracle at that time, and perhaps most of those who know it is have read about it in the gospel. And John very carefully sets the scene for us, and then unpacks it for us so that we can see the miracle and what it should mean to you and me. In John chapter 2, verse 1, on the third day. That's possibly the third day since Jesus' baptism, or perhaps maybe it's the third day since John the Baptist's testimony, which, if you quote back in the little sections of the first two chapters, that's what it is, too, but we don't really know. But on the third day, a wedding, which would have involved many people from the town, took place in Cana in Galilee, which is just a few miles up the road from Nazareth. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples also had been invited to the wedding. Any moment that I say something that's profound, and some of you missed this, I'm going to tell you this morning, my first profound thing I'm going to say this morning I'm about to say. Jesus' human life was lived out in public, there among family and friends and neighbors, in and around where he was born and he grew. That is a profound statement. I hope you'll see that as we go through this passage. But that's important for us to realize that Jesus was a real person in a real time in a real place. And that's why I said that and pointed it out to be a profound thing. You see, you and I, and a lot of people, we need to get beyond any kind of storybook thinking that Jesus and his disciples are like Peter Pan and Cinderella, just a story that we draw lessons from. Jesus is God. He is fully God. He is Creator God. He is the second person of the Holy Trinity. And he came among us to live among us as one of us so that he could do this amazing thing on the cross for us. He is part of history. He's part of now. He is not a story. And in this passage, John reports there was a wedding, a cake, and God. It's just another slice out of everyday life. And Mary and Jesus and his disciples are there. Just life and just part of it. Now, beyond my profound thoughts, and I think I have a couple of them for you this morning, I'll point them out, and I'm always sounding profound, I say profound things. But there are questions that no one really seems to fully answer. And I've always been honest with you, and I'm not just stopping honest with you now. There are things I don't know. Lots of things I don't know. What can I ask Gary? He makes something up that I don't. These questions, sometimes they bother me. But my favorite one notes that Jesus had been invited. Mary was there. And my first question is, why was Mary there? My unsupported theory, from over here, it's my unsupported theory. I don't have a verse that tells me this. I have read a couple of other weird commentators who agree with me. I believe that Mary was there for a purpose. Maybe she was the hostess. Maybe she was the caterer. Maybe she was the wedding planner. Maybe she was a close family friend who had been pulled in to help with the event. But there are some things you can't explain if there's not a reason for Mary to be there and know that she was there. Like explaining how she knew about the problem with the woman. We'll get to that. But even if I'm wrong, it doesn't change any of the truth we're going to talk about this morning. It just means my wild and crazy idea is a wild and crazy idea. And there's other two commentators I'm not sure about this. Now, I checked the map, and I know some of you know, what are you playing with a map? You don't know where anything is. But I wasn't looking for directions. I just wanted to make sure that the map was telling me that the area where this took place really was near Jesus' home, which is recent. And so, the reason I did that, I wanted to be able to ask questions of myself as I was reading through the story. Did Jesus know the couple? Did they grow up near him? Would he have known the family? And if that was the case, did it influence the miracle? Would it be done for someone he didn't know? Again, there are unanswerable questions, but if we don't ask questions, we're not going to find truth. Sometimes we ask questions and we find nothing because they're not answerable. I'm trying to help you with that. In my research on this whole concept of the first century wedding, I was affirmed something that I learned years ago. They were community affairs. Now, today, and I'm going to do doing a wedding for a young girl that I've known since she was about this big in Mark. And we've been starting the dialogue, and they're planning the whole thing. But she's been given a number. Mom said you can invite this many people to the place you want to pay for your reception. And but here, the wedding would have been a community affair. The town would show up. And it might have lasted as much as a week. How many of your mothers left at home? How many of your moms would have read left at home? And maybe that in itself explains why they ran out of wine. Maybe they were heading for a whole week. But the bottom line here, in all of that, is we know that Jesus lived a relatively normal life. He had learned a trade. He was a carpenter. He probably knew his neighbors. They probably knew him. And he went to weddings. That's my question. Do you think Jesus did? Now, you're trying to picture that, aren't you? Now, that's the line. Verse 3. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." But every time I read this passage, and it's happened twice already this morning, every time I read this passage, the first thing that pops into my mind is, he was a carpenter. What was he thinking? And his response is, "Dear woman, why do you involve me?" Exactly. That's my point. He's a carpenter with a wine problem. Why would he ask him? Jesus replies further. He says, "My time is not yet come." And his mother turns to the servant and says, "Do whatever he says." I mean, his mother was like my mother. She never listened to me either. Ask more questions. At any point, not just a sermon, at any point, if you come up with an answer to these, I'd love to sit down with you. Why did she know about the wine? It was surely not a common knowledge thing. It was a huge embarrassment to run out of wine at the wedding. Huge embarrassment. But this goes back to my idea of life and death. If he was somehow in charge, somehow responsible for different pieces of the wedding, he would have known. Is it favor, hostess, close family member, help it out? Why did she look for a solution? Why did she ask Jesus? Now, there's thought, this is not just me making stuff up, there is thought that Joseph had died by him. And Jesus, being the eldest son, was responsible for his life. And perhaps she would go to him with her questions before she went outside of him. And all I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to unpack this real life scene. And like a lot of real life scenes that you and I live, sometimes there are no answers. Why does he have to get sick? Why him? He's such a nice guy. I can't believe my basement flooded. I can't believe the roof came. There's some things in our life we can't have. This thing helps us heal. But we do learn some things about Jesus here that we need to know. First, he has a time that is very important to him. But my time is not explained. Mentioned, it's not explained, but this particular moment wasn't that time. It appears that Mary thought he could help. But he was a carpenter. But she had seen stuff happening. What did she know? Or maybe what had she seen that only a mom could see? That's what Central Apostle. What had Mary seen Jesus do in his growing up years? Did Jesus know how to make wine? Did he and his dad have a little side business? Had he done something or made something before that made her think that he could help him? And this is my favorite question. And why does somebody else's service listen to Mary? Let alone listen to Jesus, who is nothing but a guest for the community. Mary was involved somehow in the wedding, in one of those positions. And Mary probably had seen something or some things that led him to believe that Jesus, that Mary was involved in service and Mary that explained what they followed. The scholars assume, as they get here, they go off on a different tangent with things that are safe to talk about. I'm not interested in faith. I'm interested in things that are going to help us understand Jesus in a way that will invite the meaning to be saved our lives. But they assumed that Jesus was a good son. That's a given. You go back to Luke 2, and what it does there is an inappropriate behavior. He honored his parents and did what they asked him to do. And we'll also see that as the crucifixion, as he finally, breathing his last breath, one of his concerns is that John would take care of his mother. I'm not sure if I was dying and I'd be concerned about my final death, but he was a good son. A real man, in a real time, in a real place, doing real things that have life-changing impact on your life and mine. So let's go back to the water with you. Jesus' first public miracle. This is verse 6 now. Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. You do the math, you're looking at 120 to 180 gallons. And whatever was going to happen here was going to be huge. But though it's going to be huge, not everybody's going to be privy to what is going on there. Jesus said to the servants, now, this is where Mary saying, do whatever he tells you, comes into play. Because he's going to tell them to do something that doesn't make sense. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water so they fill them to the brim, which would have taken probably a good chunk of time because they would have been using buckets, bags, skins to carry the water from the well or the spring, wherever they would have found their water that they would have used. And then he told them, now draw them out and take it to the master of the banquet. And they did so. Now, anybody here ever make water? Okay, so there's a couple of them who have done that. So this is my dad. We used water, but we also used bleach, grapes, and sugar, and some other weird stuff that they put in there. You don't just dump water into a container and go, poof, water. There's no poof here, but they poured water into these containers. And the servants obeyed Jesus. That's what servants do. And that's not a big deal. But that Mary knew that Jesus could and would do something, that is, well, not as no stuff, you know? And I wonder, what were the servants saying? I love asking questions because usually you find the answer. Sometimes you don't. What were the servants thinking? Draw from the water, take it to the banquet master? Was this just simply blind obedience by trained servants? Did they think they were watching the junk unfold? Or had they seen something that's not in the past? Which leads me to ask the obvious question, when did the miracle take place? When did the miracle take place? When did it happen? And how did it happen? Think about the water. It's water for ceremonial washing. It needed to be clean with it. We don't have much details about it, but the history of the Israel Testament where it said that they used clean water. You had to be moving water. Still water would have been dirty, impure. Moving water, spring fed rough. And they would have had to go to that place and they would have to bring it. But somewhere, hidden in these lines we just read, a profound miracle took place. A profound miracle, enough so that the Apostle John, sometime in his 80s, is looking back on the life of Jesus. He's read the three other Gospels. He's writing his Gospel to explain the others. I don't know if you ever noticed that. You read Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They tell you stories, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. But doesn't do that very much. What John does is he takes us behind the story and he explains why. I'm just not convinced he did a really good job of explaining why for this one. So I'm going to look him up and I get the habit of saying, yeah, what's that? But in this scene, there is a miracle. It's a profound miracle. Water became wine. It didn't just become watered down wine. This water became the best wine. It excited. Well, we'll get to that guy in a minute. But no one actually saw it. Or it's not recorded to us. If I have to have an opinion, I do. Though a quiet meal, Jesus did this on the down low, is going to get a lot of public press because it makes one of the gospels. And it's been read for 2,000 years. Millions of people know about this miracle. Even if people then didn't get it. Jesus honored his mother. He was a good neighbor. He did what he could without violating his moral code. He tried to continue. That should be good stuff. And the master of the banquet, verse 9, not knowing the backstory, he does not know behind the scenes, tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. I often replay this in my head, and I can add the conversation of the servants as they're watching and doing this. Right? How did you do that? It was just water. Did you put something in there? I need some of that. And then he called the bride to the boy next door. Everyone brings out the choice line first. When people are sober, when people can actually know what they're doing. And they say the cheaper wine for after the guests have had too much to drink and you can sleep in anything. But you say the best for me. This is the wine expert saying, this is good stuff. This wasn't a mistake. This wasn't bottles of Welch's that was open. This was the best one. And it's moment for if you want to hang your hat on something this morning, look at this. The servant handed over a scoop of water. Maybe they were snickering, maybe they were wondering. But they handed over a scoop of water. The master of the banquet took it and he drank it. Of the best wine ever. The most amazing one. He was bragging about it. He had to stop, he had to interrupt the groom from whatever he was doing and compliment him on his integrity as his choice of wine. But it still leaves us wondering, when did the miracle take place? We have a frame of reference, but we don't know exactly when. Was it as the water was being poured into the jar? Was it as the water was being drafted out of the jar? Was it as they walked over to the master of the banquet? We're just not told, and the reason we're not told is not important. It's a detail. It enlarges story. A miracle took place. No matter what it was, a miracle took place. But I believe this is one of those miracles that forces us to look at the characters that are involved for who they are. And not necessarily what they did, because we're not actually told what they did. Because, as I've already said, this is real life. Say that with me. This is real life. It's not a fairy tale. It's not a moral lesson. I sat under pastors who gave moral lessons from the scriptures. They were disconnected from the history of the scriptures. We need any book to give us a moral lesson. But this book allows us to see the Son of God in a body on our planet, living like we live, doing these profound things that point us back to his cross. This is history. 2,000 years ago. This is what Jesus' Savior did and the impact he had on others' lives. Back then and here and now, because this is real. And I can't test this idea too much. Jesus, the Son of Mary, is a real person, a real part of history, and he remains a real person today, and he's calling on you and me to respond to his demands upon our lives. Because he laid it down, raised it up, and he continues to live so that we can have the most amazing lives possible. I hope you've noticed, as I've been going through here, that Jesus did a God thing. And he didn't bow to your thing. He did a God thing, and he didn't bow to your flaws. And my thinking is, this is the norm for God. Much of what he does, much of what he does for you and me, is just like this miracle. It just happens, often unnoticed. Maybe even uninvited good deeds that he does on our behalf for us because we're his children and he loves us. And perhaps many of our prayers are handled in the very same way. We pray hoping for a flashy answer, a precise answer, and what we get is seemingly just more of daily life, except if we were paying attention to the bigger details. Not just our circumstance, and not just what we wanted, we might have noticed that he gave us something back. We asked for this, he gave us this, because this outweighed the value of this. And often we totally miss the better things because we only have eyes for the things we can get. Now, I'm not saying we don't ask for things, specific things, but I'm saying when we ask with our eyes wide open, because God knows exactly what we need, not just what we think we need. And then John gets up to the test, which you might say, of course, it could be a commandment. First of all, this, turning water into wine, the first of his miraculous signs Jesus performed at Cana in Galilee. Generally, this again, John is pointing out this is an event that actually happened in a historical place, in a historical time. We can learn from it. Right there in front of his neighbor, and John said, he thus revealed his glory, and his disciples took their faith in him. Revealed his glory. He opened up his life. He showed a little bit about himself, but who knows? Turning up the banquet after, he was clueless. He was just surprised that the groom had finally grabbed out the good stuff. Maybe the servants, but some were not told that they understood. They didn't even understand that water had become wine until the guy started talking about it. A group of scholars took a whole group of them to write this stuff. This is what they wrote. The Gospels record 35 miracles or signs performed by Jesus. Each miracle was a sign intended to point people back then, since then, even now, you and me, to point people to the truth. Jesus is the divine Son of God, whose miracles were remarkable actions that displayed the presence and power of God. And many have wondered why Jesus would waste his power by performing a miracle providing wine for a wedding feast, a party. This particular miracle, on a deeper level, also reveals Jesus' glory. Putting water into wine with his partial unveiling of Jesus' full identity. His power over nature, death, sin, evil are going to be revealed ultimately, but here, his power over water, sugar, fruit, power of nature, death, sin. This parallels what Nicodemus said in John 3:2. We know you are the teacher, talking to Jesus, who has come from God, for no one to perform the miraculous signs you were doing if God were not with him, or better, they didn't get this, I think we get it, if he wasn't God, but he was. So the big question remains for us today, so what? What is to be our takeaway from this passage? Jesus, the Son of God, can turn water to wine. That Jesus, the Son of God, can perform miracles. That it adds a little bit of weight to his other promises. But I think there's much more. First, there's the obvious that I just described. Jesus can perform miracles. He can manipulate the laws of nature. He can violate the laws of nature. And this is just a glimpse at the power that Jesus, God, seems to wear so light. Walk around and the teacher just says, "Yes, I'm God." You dress like everybody else. You probably smell like it. Until he did the things he did. There's also obvious that Jesus seemed to enjoy a good party, and he even offered a miracle to help one. Now, I'm not thinking he, God, is the Grinch that so many people seem to want him to be. He's not that bad guy. I'm wondering sometimes how others see me or see you, see us. Are we normal people who know Jesus, attractive and inviting to others? Or are we somehow now that we have a relationship to God through Jesus, other and so perhaps even less of a witness? Do we become grinchy like we see God? Not every one of Jesus' miracles made you even live. You see, Jesus came with a mission. He came to love, he came to serve. He didn't come to run a traveling sideshow, or in a carnival. What he did was profound, what he did was on purpose, what he did was to point us toward things that we need to know so that we could trust him regardless of what our circumstances are. And in that trust, we can give him our lives and we can step forward in the circumstances. We have no clue how this is going to play out. But God's with me. He says it's going to be okay. And I've watched him do it before. As one of his, you and I might think about how we live our lives so that our lives are not a show, but our lives show him through our lives. I want to read a statement. I wrote it in a place where I wrote years ago. I even made for a this is what I wrote about this. It is essential that we think that Jesus did normal daily life just like you and me, and used everyday circumstances to weave into our shared daily life everything others needed to know, find, and embrace this truth. He lived daily life to show us how to live daily life. And I know back in his book, he did miracles, he was God, he did miracles. But I'm thinking the first part, he lived normal daily life with normal daily people, is what you and I should be doing. When we gather here on Sunday morning, we should have stories of contact, conversation, engagement, doing things with people who are not us. There are way too many meeting in rooms this morning, some right now. Their sole purpose as a Christian is what happens in this room, and nothing else changes in the rest of their lives. Shame on them. Jesus lived normal daily life so that he could be us when he hung on the cross. We should live normal daily life so that we can represent Jesus when we're with other people. And so I ask the question, what if we learn from Jesus to live life weaving love and faith and mercy and grace into the routine as if these things are normal too? Love, truth, mercy, and grace are to be normal parts of our lives, not the exception. But do we live the kind of life where people would get that is normal? Not just this weird person doing this odd thing that made me feel better, but it's what my neighbor does. It's who she is. you and I impact is Jesus and his kingdom. If Jesus and his kingdom didn't seem so odd, or so weird, or so painful, or so... I was with a group of dear friends, Christians, the other day, and we were worshiping, singing. And we're in kind of a circle, a broken circle, but we're in a circle. As I was singing, I stopped singing. Because there were people on the other side of the circle that looked like they were in pain. And what we were singing should have made us happy. We should have been joyous. We should have looked around. And sometimes I think we just miss the opportunity to be normal because we're trying to do something that we're not for Jesus. Jesus performed most of his miracles in a public context of normal daily. It was as if he was intentional to be around those who needed the touch that only he could provide. And perhaps we could be more kingdom effective, more kingdom useful, if we lived our Christian lives among people more kingdom focused, helping heaven come to earth. Or to our cousin, or our friend, or our neighbor, or our co-worker, or our classmate. Here's the dream. Knowing Jesus and what he can do. One more thing. We might not perform the same kind of miracles. Get that? We might not perform the same kind of miracles, but what we do for and with other people, loving words and deeds, might feel like miracles to them. We might not perform the same kind of miracles, but what we do for and with other people, loving words and deeds, might feel like miracles to them. Say, to whom is my life